Hello, and welcome to Cranfield University. In this interview series, we explore the role of philosophy and humanities more broadly for management, engineering, but also for our everyday lives. My name is Andrei Pavlov, and I'm Professor of Strategy and Performance here in the School of Management.
And I'm Toby Thompson. My interest is in Heidegger and in continental philosophy, and I'm the studio director here at Cranfield University.
And in the studio with us today, we've got Professor Dominic Scott, Professor of Philosophy at the University of Oxford. Dominic, welcome. Welcome to Cranfield.
And thank you for having me.
Dominic, if you allow me to just jump in straight into the question that I find the most interesting one. I know that a few years ago, you ran the Forum for Philosophy in Business at Cambridge, where you actually had practitioners, business people, interact with you and your colleagues in all matters philosophy and ethics. Can you tell me a bit more about this? How did this come about? What was the inspiration behind it? How did it work?
Yes. So a colleague of mine, Alex Oliver, who works in ethics and also mathematical logic, so a broad area in philosophy, we had done some seminars together, and he happened to know by pure chance someone who worked in the university, the corporate liaison office. And in Cambridge, it has such strong and wide industrial links that this office was dealing with a number of very different companies who were coming to the university really to talk to the scientists. So engineering companies, pharmaceutical, telecommunications. And someone in this office thought, well, why don't they also talk to other disciplines like the humanities, like philosophy or anthropology? And this person and Alex and I, we got talking, and essentially this office agreed to put us in touch with companies who were coming perhaps for other reasons, and just to start a conversation about how philosophy might inform their practice, perhaps especially to do with ethical topics, be the starting point. And over time, we started rather tentatively, and then we isolated various topics that were interesting to philosophers and also to the businesses we were talking to, and essentially the thing grew. We called it a Forum for Philosophy and Business because the idea was not that we would come and sort of preach philosophy at them and give them philosophy lectures. The idea is that we would meet with them and listen to them and find out what problems they were thinking about, what was worrying them, and whether any of those problems had a philosophical dimension. And also in the back of our minds was the idea that philosophy itself would be enriched by this, because there may be topics out there which philosophers have not thought about enough, which would be really fruitful for philosophy. I mean, just to jump in with an example.
That would be great.
We're talking to a consultant who obviously had a experience with a wide range of companies. He himself had studied philosophy back in the day, and he said one area which is giving a number of companies a lot of sort of ethical headaches is intellectual property. This is obviously in the pharmaceutical industry. Holding on to your property rights may mean that you're withholding drugs from people who need them, who can't afford the prices, given the property regime. So, you know, that's an obvious ethical dilemma. But although obviously lawyers talk about this, we all agreed philosophers should, because the whole idea of ownership of ideas, if you like, of formulae or whatever it is, that's surely very intriguing. What are the objects of intellectual ownership? And then how do you draw the boundaries around them? And how do you balance the need to share ideas, to share medical inventions with the need to reward and incentivize people? So we started working with practitioners, people in pharmaceutical industries. But we also saw another thing that became very important was to work with other academic disciplines, obviously in this case, intellectual property lawyers who were very strong in Cambridge and have their own unit. So gradually we had seminars, we started doing research on it, we managed to fund some graduate students, and we really saw this as an example of an area that some philosophers had already talked about. In fact, I think even Immanuel Kant had written briefly on copyright, but it was something that could really be developed to the benefit of both philosophy and business, and obviously intellectual property law. So that was an example, but we also looked at tax law, and then we looked in other areas at employee-company relations. And we ended up working with a variety of different companies, and we had seminars on various topics, and that carried on for a good 5 years. And it really gave us proof of concept that there's a real interest out there in business, in philosophical topics, and a desire for kind of dialogue there. So that was the idea of the forum.
Yes, and that is certainly something that I also discovered here at Cranfield when we started introducing philosophy to business. I didn't expect there to be such hunger and such thirst for these ideas. So it's really interesting. Can you talk a little bit more about what you think your guests and the members of the forum were getting out of it? What sort of questions were they bringing to you? Why did they want to talk to philosophers?
Well, sometimes there would be you took a sort of example of an ethical problem. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's a matter of breaking the problem down and isolating the assumptions behind it. Sometimes it's breaking down the different motivations you might have. So, you know, with something like corporate philanthropy, you know, are you doing that purely to improve an image that's been tainted by some scandal in the past? Well, if you go down that route, you can end up making matters worse. So you end up talking about motivation, egoism, and altruism. And so sometimes just having a seminar, for instance, as you might with philosophy students or other philosophers, about whether we act egoistically or altruistically and how you balance the two. If you just get people to think philosophically, then the practitioners can take that back and use the clarity they have to think about their own specific programs in some specific kind of philanthropy, you know, drug donations or whatever. And also very importantly, to think about the messaging around it. You know, if you just say, you know, we are a company who are our sole purpose is human health, no one's going to believe you, because surely you're there to maximize shareholder dividends as well. So if you think carefully and honestly with yourself, what are your motivations? To what extent are they egoistic or altruistic? That can then inform, among other things, the way you communicate yourself to others.
Dominic, what was the temptation then to prejudge the expectations on both sides, what you thought that they would want and what they thought you could provide? Was there a temptation to do that?
Yes, I think that's a very good question, because you might think there must be some philosophical theory that these people need to know about. Some article, a chapter of Kant, and we must isolate it, mug it up before we meet these people, and then give them a lecture.
Yeah,
so that would be, and maybe they're expecting the same. You know, if you go along to the engineering department, you're expecting to give you some invention, or a pharmaceutical will give you a drug formula, and you take it away and sell it. In the event, we were not there to give them a philosophical theory that they could then use. Worse still, some theory they could then use to justify dubious behavior. That was not the idea. I remember when we managed to get a little article about ourselves in the Times Higher Education Supplement, because we are doing some work with BT. and they gave us a nice description of what we're up to. But they also got their cartoonist on the case.
I can imagine it.
We would be discussing customer satisfaction and talking to people and customer complaints. And the cartoon had an executive sitting at his desk with customer complaints on it, on the phone to a very angry customer. And the guy said, could I stop you there? You say you're angry, but how do you know you even exist? So the idea was, you know, the joke behind it is that you could sort of find some nifty philosophical problem or theory and then just bring it in and solve a business problem.
Yeah.
So that was, I don't think we ever really had that expectation too strongly. But what you should do, I think, is go in and really have a dialogue. Listen to the way they talk about their business problems, what's worrying them. And then after a dialogue, you can go away and do some research and come back. But the thing is, I think, to hear them talk and then help clarify some of the problems, the presuppositions they have. What happened was, after having done that and got a sense of what, say, the problems in pharmaceutical ethics are, then you can start doing some research and even commissioning research, and companies would commission us to do research. And then you can start seeing the foundations of new avenues in academia, so philosophy benefits. But that's almost in reverse of the temptation we might have had, which was to come along with ready-made philosophical theories.
Were there any surprises, or do you remember a memorable moment from working with the forum?
I'm sure there are many interesting moments. I suppose one of the things I was surprised about, this happened later when I had gone over to Virginia, and I was asked by the business school to help out with some executive education on leadership. And there they really wanted me to talk about my core research, which actually is on ancient Greek philosophy. And they wanted me to talk about Plato's Republic and the cave allegory. And I have to admit, I was a little bit nervous about this. I mean, why are, you know, the participants going to be interested in a guy 2,500 years old? But I just launched straight in, and I was amazed at how interested they were in Plato and how he just resonates down the centuries. When I say amazed, I mean, at some level I wasn't, because I think that's the genius of Plato, he manages to do that. But I was very pleasantly surprised that I didn't get my head bitten off for talking about ancient Greeks. I think. Another example that slightly surprised me was, in general, when you go into one of these conversations or seminars, you don't know which bits of philosophy they might be interested in.
Exactly.
So it's very handy, being the kind of academics that we were, that in Cambridge, you would have your specialism, whether it's Plato or mathematical logic, but you also do a lot of small group teaching across modern ethics or modern metaphysics. So that could be eight areas per teaching topic. You know, there are only 10 or 11 philosophy lecturers in my department, so we had to teach quite broadly. So in the back of your head, you've got actually quite a lot of material. And sometimes it would just turn out to be useful. So you'd have sort of rummage around your head a bit and then come out with it. Now, one of the things we found is that often a company would have a new sort of program, often centered around a word. I mean, to be rude, it might be a buzzword, but like, or a phrase like customer loyalty, or something, you know, trust building and so on. Sometimes it would even be a phrase the company might have invented, like one company we spoke to were talking about co-invention as a way of, you know, developing new ideas. Or if it's public sector, they might be talking about public engagement. And then you would sit down, and then as philosophers, you'd say, well, okay, so these people are building a program around this term, this phrase, this buzzword. What do they mean by it? And so my first thought was, I'm going to be Socrates. I'm going to sort of be really annoying and ask for definitions. And the thing I found, which wasn't a surprise, but then I wasn't particularly expecting it either, is you could have eight people who are tasked with leading this project, say, in developing customer loyalty, no longer just customer satisfaction, but let's go for something bigger and brighter and more positive customer loyalty. So you just try and get a sense going around the table what people understand by that. And it may turn out they actually understand rather different things. Trust is a very basic example. Is trust something essentially effective or emotive? When you trust someone, is it because you feel some positive emotion towards them? Or is trust something cognitive that's based on perhaps the limited evidence you have about them, and based on that you make a judgment to, entrust them with your money or whatever? Is it a cognitive thing, effective, or a bit of both? And that really matters. If you're trust building, then maybe it's a matter of marketing or advertising to build up positive feelings in your consumers. But if it's something cognitive, then it's a matter of sharing information, being open to release more information when people ask you questions, making sure you're accessible. Right? So when you sit down and discuss with people, what do they understand by this term, you might find around the table, people have really quite different views, and that can lead to serious practical problems as you take the program further and further forward. People will diverge more and more. But one thing we found was it's probably a bad idea to try and get everyone to agree on a single definition. And then Wittgenstein suddenly popped into my head. I'm not a Wittgenstein scholar, but I've interested in his whole idea of family resemblances.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Famous example of don't try and find a single definition for the term game. There could be several different strands to it. And I was struck how well this went down with corporate audiences in seminars. It's like scales falling from eyes. That there may not be one definition, at least in any given context. And as I worked more, I found this is definitely the case with leadership. So that was an example where I was surprised that some bit of knowledge in my head or understanding suddenly came in handy, and I didn't go into the room expecting to talk about Wittgenstein. So that would be one example.
I want to understand more about levels of appreciation and levels of knowledge, but it almost strikes me there are two tribes, the philosopher tribe and the corporate tribe, with possibly a degree of skepticism or cynicism on both sides. But then it seemed to me that it's possibly condescending to say that you took philosophy for a trial run, like you're driving a new car. A philosophy doesn't need that because it's worked for the last few thousand years. Does that two-tribe thing make sense to you, or is that condescending too?
Well, I suppose you can say in what sense has philosophy worked for 2,500 years? I mean, some people say philosophers never seem to come up with solutions. They just, the moment someone thinks they come up with a solution, then in move the objectors, and then you're back to one of the most famous problems in philosophy, the problem of induction. Someone said, the fact that it hasn't been solved after all this time is one of the great scandals of philosophy. So, yes. So what counts as success in philosophy? Well, in terms of influence, some say political philosophy has had enormous influence, obviously, over the centuries. Sometimes it takes decades, even centuries, for that influence to happen, but it certainly does. Sometimes philosophy is successful by breeding a new discipline. So what once might have been part of philosophy becomes feeds into psychology or economics or sociology. So almost the success of philosophy is it loses a limb of itself. But I suppose in this case, what hadn't happened so much is philosophy engaging with the corporate world, and that's still something that is it's not that frequently done. It's not part of the regular philosophical day-to-day business. You know, if you have a philosophy department, they will have regular posts. So they'll have someone who teaches ethics or even, you know, applied ethics or the history of ethics. And then when they retire, that post will be filled by someone else. So you have a regular post, but you don't have, most departments have a philosophy of business post. Obviously, in business schools, you have that, and there are whole journals. But philosophy of business is not a part of philosophy. I mean, it's interesting to compare, I find, with philosophy of education. You know, when you look at Plato, he's obsessed with that topic. It takes up a lot of space in his most famous work, The Republic, or his last work, The Laws. So for him, education was one of the core areas of philosophy. And nowadays, there is certainly philosophy of education, but it tends to be practiced in education colleges. There are journals, I think, of philosophy of education, but it's not a mainstream subject in philosophy itself. So I think philosophy of business is, there's so much potential there, but it is inhibited, I think, just by perhaps institutional inertia, or maybe there is a sense of tribalism on both sides.
Do you think, didn't mean to interrupt. Yeah. Do you think there are any misconceptions about what philosophy is on the part of the business community? And could that be a barrier?
My experience with it is that there were quite different views of it in the business community. It was very difficult to generalize. I mean, if you wanted a quick and easy negative perception, it would simply be that philosophy is too abstract to be of any relevance. I mean, that would be that. You might think, oh, philosophers are all going to be left-wing liberal, they're going to hate companies. I didn't find that. I think the real problem was, we got our heads in the clouds. So you had to persuade them you can have your head in the clouds and feet on the ground at the same time. You know, that's and one way of bridging the gap is through a subject like law, because law is a wonderful example of how you can have at one hand very abstract theorizing about property. So to take an example, but then, you know, the black letter law, nitty gritty statutes about property ownership. So I think law always has a philosophical side, sort of upstairs department, and that's a natural place for philosophical dialogue to happen. But maybe for philosophers to have impact with business, we need to work more with subjects like law and economics, who are more used to dealing directly with companies.
I want to bring you round to your book, Listening to Reason, Plato and Aristotle. What's the big deal with reason?
I think the big deal was the death of Socrates, to put it in a nutshell. So there was Socrates, so he's Plato's mentor. You wouldn't want to say teacher, because Socrates, you know, claimed not to be able to teach anyone, but he was Plato's mentor. And he was a public intellectual. He just went around Athens badgering people.
Troublemaker.
Yeah. Troublemaker, yeah. And he seemed to like making trouble with famous people who were opinionated. So, Plato gives an example of asking a general, define courage, and the guy can't do it. Right? But the general doesn't get too angry, but it would seem a little bit embarrassing if you're a distinguished military guy and your views on courage turn to ash in Socrates' hands. So, but he did this especially, I think, with poets and politicians who claimed to understand, you know, the nature of justice, or poets who thought there was some deep truth in what they were saying. And Socrates would show that they were possibly intellectual frauds. Unfortunately, some of the people he acted as mentor to went on to have very dubious political careers, like someone called Alcibiades, And so Socrates basically got a very bad name, and he was put to death by the Athenian government. Now, this government was not a sort of oligarchic a junta or anything. It was a democracy. And they put him to death to shut him up. They even said, look, Socrates, if you stop philosophizing, we'll let you off. You know, we'll just fine you. He said, I will not stop philosophizing even if I have to die 1,000 deaths. So they put him to death. And I think that for Plato raised the question, you know, here is somebody who went out there, champion of rational argument, trying to persuade people, and when he had his own views, to accept them. And the result is violence. So what hope is there for rational argument? Who will listen to reason? And I think Plato really wrestled with this, because in his Republic, he has only a tiny number of citizens or be philosophers. Everyone else will sort of toe the line and learn the basic moral truths through stories told in infancy, but they won't be Socratic philosophers. And Aristotle said, most people won't listen to reason because their passions and appetites will block them. So before you do anything like engage with moral philosophy with people, you need to train the character, the fabric of the soul, our desires and our appetites. So there's a sort of gloom that set in about our capacity to respond to rational argument, I think, following the death of Socrates. And that's something Plato and Aristotle both wrestled with. But I sort of read between the lines, I think Plato wasn't wholly pessimistic. He just thought you have to be very, very careful about how you reason with people. And although he was very scathing about rhetoric earlier in his career, as he gets older, he thinks more and more about the effective uses of rhetoric. So alongside rational argument, appealing to the emotions in the right way can facilitate people's amenability to argument. So I wrote about it because I thought Plato and Aristotle had very complicated positions on what is a fundamentally important and perennial problem, as we all know now.
But there are important stakeholder groups that are left out, the incontinent, those driven by emotion, and the education for a philosopher ruler is almost a lifetime. It's a very long education. So it seems very narrow then. What's left is really quite narrow. Who can learn from philosophy?
That's right. I mean, in Aristotle, he does seem to rule out those who have sort of surrendered themselves to their passions. And for them, there would just be some kind of rhetoric. That does seem pessimistic. My view is with Plato, he's actually more liberal in this sense. And he thinks that if you package it in the right way and you really think about how to appeal to the emotions, you will make headway. I think that was at least his hope. And some of his dialogues, like his dialogue, The Phaedrus, which is about rhetoric, but also contains one of the most passionate passages about the value of philosophy, that down the ages has actually been, I think, taken up and read by people who are by no means academic philosophers. So I think Plato invented a kind of philosophical rhetoric to get around this problem. So I think he was more liberal than Aristotle.
But then you have Aristotle's very dim view of women in terms of thinking, in terms of what we're talking about here. How do you square that?
That's very interesting. Yeah, Aristotle, when he talks about women, he makes just a few very brief remarks. And he says their reason lacks authority. Mm. And on the basis of that seems to exclude them from political power. And unfortunately, he says so little about it, but it's so important, given that Plato has thought that women are as entitled to hold power as men are. Aristotle seems to row right back on that, just with this one word, their reason somehow is lacks authority. And no one is, well, we're not agreed as to what he meant by that. Some people think, he said that women, they're capable of making practical decisions, but then their emotions sort of take over and stop them following through. I really don't think that's what he's saying. And I don't see anything in Aristotle that says why women can't actually do philosophy. I don't. But we, the problem is we have so little evidence of what Aristotle thought about that. Whereas with Plato, we have an extended passage in the Republic where he argues for the place of women as philosophers and philosopher rulers. So that's one of his brighter moments, I would say.
So you could say philosophy has a bad rap based on that, rather narrow, doesn't include, I don't know whether your view of philosophy includes non-Western philosophy, whether it does include non-reason approaches. It could be very, very slim, what we're talking about.
I mean, it's certainly would include non-Western philosophy. If it does, I suppose with the question of reason, you might say, well, sorry, but that's what defines philosophy is the use of reason. That's not to say other modes of communication and engagement aren't really important. And some of those modes might combine the two. So novelists might be philosophers and obviously engage your emotions. I've recently become very interested in the way Tolstoy uses Plato. He was fascinated by Plato. He says in his 20s and 30s, Plato is one of his most strongest influences. He quotes him in Anna Karenina. So there's a sort of philosophical substrate to his work, but obviously at the same time, he engages with your emotions. So it's possible to do both, but you might say, but when you're a philosopher, when you're in teaching philosophy, it is the use of reason that predominates. I mean, that's a view. I don't think that's excluding people who want to, as it were, think through the emotions, because there are other areas in which you can do that. But I think it is true to say that Plato did, and Aristotle actually thought the emotions do help us philosophize better. I mean, with Aristotle, you've have this famous, the doctrine of the mean, you know, you shouldn't feel too much anger, but equally you shouldn't feel too little anger. There's no emotion you shouldn't feel. And some scholars thought part of his idea was that if you feel too little of an emotion like pity or anger, you actually fail to see things that are morally important. Your anger or your pity stimulates your reason to think, well, what are we going to do about this? So practical reason depends on some of the emotions. And in the Republic, Plato thought that what the emotions like pride or shame, he called them the ally of reason. And perhaps he thought that we need those emotions to sort of keep reason on track. Don't let it go to sleep. When you realize something is wrong and injustice needs to be rectified, then you will start reasoning and deliberating about how to do that. But maybe you need the emotions to kickstart you. One scholar who's stressed that is Martha Nussbaum, I think.
Yes.
The passion of reason. Yes. So I'm being entirely consistent here. Is philosophy, you know, as a practice, is it purely about the use of reason? I'm sure if Immanuel Kant, you would say, yes. Yes. There are parts of Plato, it sounds, yes. But then there's this other side to it where actually, certainly in practical reason, you need it to work with the emotions. So Aristotle distinguished purely theoretical reason is independent of the emotions, but practical reason, the word phronesis, works in consort with the emotions in the way perhaps I described as being stimulated by them. So it's a complicated business. Yeah.
So you wouldn't say, one more, you wouldn't have much truck with Wilfred Sellers' definition then that the aim of philosophy is to understand how things in the broadest possible sense hang together in the broadest possible sense. You wouldn't agree with that?
Well, I think with theoretical reason, that's definitely the case. And even when you're doing ethics, you know, there's meta-ethics. You can think about what does ethics study? Are there objective values? You can think about what does ethical language attempt to communicate? those kinds of inquiry, the seller's view is absolutely fine. That's true. So a lot of philosophy falls into that camp. But it may be that when you're engaged in practical ethics, especially, I mean, sort of thinking of our context of ethics in business, or it could be ethics in a hospital, where you're really thinking about ethical decision-making on the ground, you might say there's something perverse about excluding the emotions mm-hmm. from that. So maybe there's a bit of philosophy that still needs the emotions, but yeah, I mean, vast tracts of philosophy are, as you described it. And I think that point about seeing interconnections, joining things together, that's so important. And many different levels, whether purely abstract philosophy or practical philosophy, I think that's core to it.
Can I bring us back to business and leadership, while still talking about about Plato, of course, and practical reason as well? Your most recent book, Dominic, that you wrote with Edward Freeman, the University of Virginia, is about Plato's conception of leadership. And can you tell us a bit more about what we can learn from Plato about leadership and why this is still interesting and still relevant?
Certainly, yeah. So I think I heard you say conception of leadership. Especially in the way the book is about his conceptions in plural,
yes,
of leadership.
Indeed.
Yes. Which is surprising to people who've encountered Plato. You tend to think of him as someone who wanted a single definition.
Yeah, an authoritative definition, yeah.
Exactly. Leadership is, and then we, on the other side of it, is we find a formula that will encapsulate all cases of leadership. And when I was working with Ed Freeman in the Darden School of Business in Virginia, we did some seminars on leadership. And I was taking up that idea I mentioned earlier from my work with a forum in Cambridge about there not being one definition, and that you have the Wittgensteinian strand, so the rope. So the rope looks like a single thing, but it's actually made of these different strands. And then I found that when you look at Plato, say, his Republic, which is his most famous work on politics, and really spends a huge amount of time talking about political leadership, when you look at that, you don't actually find a single definition. He's very keen on trying to find a single definition of the virtue of justice, or courage. But when it comes to leadership, there isn't such a thing. And we know that, well, we think we know, but it's often thought that Plato was himself very interested in political leadership because he had ideas or ambitions to become a political leader one day, and then he abandoned those ambitions. But he remained very interested in what makes a great leader. And the Athenians were interested in how you become a leader. Is it by going to sort of leadership school? Is it by luck? Is it by God's grace? Is it by just practice? And Plato was always keen that before you ask questions about how you acquire it, you should find out what it is. So the question was close to his heart right from the early period. But when you get to the central work, if you like, the Republic, you don't find a single definition. What you do find, and this goes back to his interest, I think, in rhetoric and in communicating with people who aren't, you know, professional philosophers, he uses a load of images or metaphors. So I found a list of them. So he talks about the leader as captain of the ship. We're familiar with, you know, the ship of state. The leader as a doctor who's curing the social ills, the leader as an artist who has a vision and then tries to recreate that model
in the real life. Yeah.
And then later, after the Republic, a dialogue called the Statesman, the leader becomes a weaver, trying to weave together these very different kinds of citizen. The leader as shepherd was already known. You've got that in Homer. And then I also think there's the leader as a sower of seeds who steps back and watches them grow. So we had all these images, and that fitted with my experience of dealing with executives, you know, when talking about trust or loyalty, that don't try and throw a single definition at them. Just look at all the different contexts in which we use these words and see whether different strands emerge. And so when I was teaching in executive education with Ed Freeman in Virginia, I just listed these models. I sketched them very briefly. I added in the leader as a teacher. And I said to them, in your experience, and they had a lot of experience of different companies, or some of the state legislators, in your experience, which most resonates, or which kind of leader would you most like to be, which was required in which kind of situation? And I found people got really interested in that. So I ended up writing up my own views, at least starting with what Plato thought. So for instance, the ship's captain, that was an old metaphor. It had already been used and we still use it. And the idea was, you know, you have to keep the ship safe from all the storms and get it to its destination. And then when you look at Plato's use of it, he does a thing he loves doing, which is taking something that's quite old, it's not original, but then giving it his own very peculiar twist. So he's got this idea that leaders need to have expertise. In politics, democratic politics, and that can be problematic because you don't give someone power just because they've got a lot of degrees or something, you give it because they've got the votes, right? But Plato thought, no, in any other enterprise, if it was building ships or building city defences, you would want an expert. So why not in politics? And then he goes a step further. If you want the ideal state, you want people with moral expertise. Mm-hmm. But if you want moral expertise, he thinks you have to go very, very abstract. You have to do philosophy. So you need a kind of expertise that most people think is utterly irrelevant. So it's going to be really difficult persuading people to be led by philosopher rulers. So the ship of state, he says, you know, people may agree on the destination, but in order to chart your course, you have to, at least in those days, you did nautical astronomy. You have to look at the position of the stars. So the guy actually, instead of looking ahead, he looks up to the stars, and everyone thinks, oh, he's got his head in the clouds, or not clouds if you're trying to look at stars, but this guy has not got his feet on the ground. But Plato says, that is my point. Mm. In order to rule, you need highly abstract kinds of expertise. But also his point raises the idea that if you are trying to get the ship on course and take it in a direction people weren't expecting, you've also got to keep order on board, right? So you've got to be both outward looking and inward looking. And that's the challenge. If you start thinking through the ship of state, that is the ship as captain's got a sort of almost impossible task of being quite remote in one sense, having this very remote kind of abstract expertise, but on the other hand, relating to people so well that they will trust you and get behind you, even then when you're recommending something painful.
Presumably then it would be foolish in a business school not to have a philosophy elective like you do here at Cranford.
Or like you did in Cambridge.
Exactly. It would be foolish. What are the barriers to having something like a philosophy program in an exec ed situation?
I suppose it's unusual.
It certainly is unusual.
Yeah. And I think I was thinking through this problem that what we did in Cambridge, we got this sort of corporate liaison office to gather around a sort of group of interested executives, and then we made contact with alumni. I had a former student of mine who had set up his own consultancy, which was very much interested in bringing humanities and business together. So he already had contact. So you get a group of willing people, a small number, and then, you know, all goes well, you have a really fruitful discussion that could then lead to other things. But if you're talking about having a course in a school with a syllabus, and a curriculum, then the question is, what is going to be on that curriculum? Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking almost you have to think long term. If you, going back to this idea that if a philosophy department would embrace the idea of philosophy of business as a core component of the syllabus, then over time, students will take that up, graduate students, postdocs, there'll be more publications in it. And that's publications written by philosophers who do other areas of philosophy. That's not in any way to disparage all the work done in business ethics, in business ethics journals or in business schools. But it would be great to make this mainstream for philosophers, where a philosopher who writes on ethics might also be writing on philosophy of mind or epistemology. And it would be wonderful if you had people writing on business problems who were also writing on, say, metaphysics. What is the ontological status of the objects of intellectual property ownership? You know, something that someone who works on metaphysics could also write on that. So imagine it became a mainstream philosophical
conversation,
subdiscipline. Mm. There are then publications on it by philosophers. They then become part of a syllabus and curriculum. Yeah. You have the Cambridge Companion to Philosophy and Business, you know, which students can use as a... I think when you can just present a reading list that includes items from people in business schools or law schools, to be sure, but also from people in philosophy schools, then you can say, yeah, well, there's a sub-discipline of philosophy here. Let's build a curriculum around it, I think. So, and there are already people like, I think, Halvard Lillehammer, who has got a module in philosophy, business and society. I think if programs like that keep going, it just establishes a norm, other philosophy departments take it up, and then they can migrate to, say, business schools, and the business school curriculum could include their publications. And I think it's important if philosophy departments that do that really do have links with businesses. And that's not difficult to do, as I said, given the fact that universities will already have their links, and alumni would help. I always said that when we are thinking of raising money for our forum, I was thinking what we really want is intellectual fundraising. We want to go to alumni who done philosophy, gone into business, and as a result of their experience say, well, that bit of philosophy I studied, that really comes to life now. You know? So I think if you institutionalized it more, then it becomes less of a shock to maybe a business school to have a, it can be very inspiring if you have the right people doing it and the students talk about it afterwards, that's great. But if the person giving the course then leaves or goes elsewhere, the danger is the thing just folds.
It disappears, yeah.
The critics the critics who are watching this could say, well, that's all fine for you to say, Dominic, because you're in the luxuriously appointed, despite power cuts, humanities department there at Oxford University. Not every university or business school has that luxury. What would you say to those critics?
Well, I think in a philosophy department, I'll give you an example. I was for a year at the University of Kent, and they were very innovative about the undergraduate offerings they wanted to think. And they actually asked me to set up a module in the philosophy of business. It was actually been easier for me to teach that than sort of pre-Socratic philosophy or Stoic philosophy. As my life turned out, I then moved on from there. So I didn't do that. I think someone else did do that. But actually, when you think of it, if you're an undergraduate dean, you do need to recruit students. Students are taking out loans. Of course, if they're passionate about doing philosophy, that's wonderful. But what are they going to do after that? Well, having philosophy in business gives them kind of best of both worlds, because you're allowed to do very abstract topics, but you just get to know how certain businesses work. So if I was teaching a module like that, I would perhaps do something quite abstract, like what is the nature of a corporation? You know, is it more than just the sum of its employees? Corporate social responsibility, what do we mean by responsibility there? But to give the course more kind of traction, say, well, let's look at some specific industries. My favorite case is a pharmaceutical, because that's just so, you know, where healthcare comes up against profit making. It's a great sort of theme for finding moral dilemmas. But the students just get to know an industry a bit better. They get to know about law. And I think that really helps them when they go out on the job market. One of my students from Cambridge said a high point in one of her law interviews was when she could talk about what she studied on the course component we put on in Cambridge about corporate responsibility. So actually, the less luxurious the university, I think the more interested they would be in having philosophy in business.
That's interesting.
And maybe potentially more impactful as well.
Well, impact is another very important thing for British universities.
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't mean it in that way, but yes.
Yes, yes, sorry.
Could I broaden it a little bit, this conversation? I know you were also a co-author on the Humanities World Report. Well, so you looked at the state of humanities around the world. And is there an argument for bringing humanities more broadly into professional schools like business schools or engineering, besides philosophy? And if we do that, should philosophy still lead this conversation, you think?
I'm sure there is. So, for instance, when I was working on the leadership book, what we did was to look at the Platonic passages where he talks about his models, but then Ed Freeman brought in some case studies. So people recognize as great leaders over the last 100 years, but obviously quite recent leaders, both in politics and business. And we use them to illustrate the models. But as looking into it, because we were co-authoring the book, so he came up with the case studies, but I wanted to be absolutely sure they fitted with Plato. I started reading about them more and more, like Frederick Douglass, the anti-slavery campaigner in the 19th century. And I just wanted to know more and more about the history of it. You know, I discovered that he set up his own newspaper called The North Star,
which
is that is the navigational model, but I kind of wanted to know, how did he do this? Who did he get to write? Or we talked about Florence Nightingale and how her battles with the British medical establishment was like someone coming down from Plato's cave
argue. And of course, Nelson Mandela weaving together different parts of
exactly.
of the society.
But when, you know, when you're writing a book like that, you have to keep it short, and I won't say simple, but it's got to be clear. But when you talk to historians, I mean, some of the historians I know, their job is to make things more complicated than philosophy and moral dilemmas are so complicated, we try and bring not simplicity but at least clarity. I'm always struck whenever I start talking with a historian just how naive our preconceptions of such and such a leader actually are. So I think there's a real need for the history, you know, and same with literature, which I think has already been done, you know, bringing in Tolstoy, War and Peace and so on. So, but yes, I think there's a real appetite for the humanities, and done well, people just love it. They enjoy it. You know,
Tolstoy's War and Peace is also a required reading in my philosophy elective as well.
The whole book.
Not the whole book, but certainly excerpts where Tolstoy talks about the nature of leadership as well.
Yes.
So I think in the past maybe decade or maybe 15 years, I think to me there's been an explosion of interest in philosophy in general. Are you seeing this as well? And where do you think this is going?
Certainly, I think on where I'm in Oxford, our numbers of applicants are very healthy. In Oxford, I really do specialise on ancient Greek philosophy. It's a sort of centre for it. But I'm just so delighted at the interest from all around the world in the subject. So I would never join the pessimists who think we're all going to be extinct tomorrow. And I think it gives us more clarity on our own ideas because, you know, Western philosophy is so indebted to the ancient Greeks. But at the same time, you certainly realize that you are studying a completely different world. There's a diversity about it. You know, Plato talks about, if you like, a priori knowledge in the same breath as talking about reincarnation. So you get this really interesting cocktail of the familiar and the unfamiliar. And there just seem to be an almost infinite number of levels in his thought. So people keep coming for more, and I think. But philosophy itself, it's always looking at, you know, what are the big challenges at the moment? How can we be helping? So artificial intelligence is currently a growing field. So philosophy is not, you know, it's not falling asleep. So I'm very optimistic.
Where would you like to see it go in the next 10 years, the role of philosophy in practical professions like management, like engineering, and in society more broadly?
Well, I think very much what we've been talking about and what you yourself are doing at Cranley, which is embedding it in the curricula at professional schools, business schools, and not just in a few places, but making it the norm. I think that's what I would like. I mean, there's some wonderful authors who write philosophy for the public, and in general, publishers have been very good about producing sort of the companion to this or the compendium of that, and so it's become much more accessible. I think that's all in a very healthy state. And you think of Melvyn Bragg and In Our Time, you can turn on the radio, 9 o'clock in the morning, they're talking about Immanuel Kant. You know,
that's a shock.
That's great. So I think that's quite healthy, and publishers are on the game there. I'm interested, in entrenching it in still in academia, in professional schools. So in business schools, and making it more acceptable there. And for that, as I said, I think it really helps if philosophy itself takes the subject of business really more seriously. It's very good at talking about the ethics of the individual. It's great about talking about the ethics of the polis or the political theory. But if you want to know about the ethics or the philosophical issues around the corporation, it's like a sort of, if you're in a bookshop, this is one of my former students and running a company. He said to me, if you want to know about ethics or politics, you go to philosophy section. If you want to know about business ethics, you probably have to go up two floors or down two floors. Mm-hmm. It's in another. Mm-hmm. But why is this? Why is that area of human life central to philosophy? And so I think that's what I would like to see happening. And I have no reason to see why it should.
I couldn't agree more.
Imagine yourself, Dominic, in that bookshop. Where do you get your inspiration aside from ancient Greek philosophy? What sections would you go to? What inspires you?
I've said at the moment, I mentioned I was getting very interested in Tolstoy in literature. And as reading some of his work, the Kreutzer Sonata, there's a chapter around music there that just made me think this guy must have been reading Plato. And then lo and behold, turns out one of the last things he wrote was a translation of a dialogue by Plato, the Phaedo, you know, and one of the first influences was Plato. At the end of Anna Karenina, the character Levin has this great epiphany, which gets rid of his angst about the meaninglessness of life, and it's all sparked by hearing about a peasant called Plato who lives for his soul. And so I just find it fascinating that an author of the genius of Tolstoy was still being inspired by Plato. And so that's the moment that's, I think, looking to literature more is what I would do, I think. Has also helped as I'm playing, I play the piano, and I was playing the Kreutzer Sonata with a violinist friend of mine, and so that all fed in as well.
Very good. Well, Dominic, for us at least, this has been a fantastic conversation.
Amazing.
Really enjoyed it. So thank you very much for your time and for sharing your insights and ideas with us. And I certainly share your kind of your hope in developing philosophy and bringing philosophy closer to business in a more structured, more institutionalized way.
That's given me hope as well. So I really appreciate, Dominic, what you said about the business side of philosophy and the philosophy side of business.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And I really admire what you're doing at Cranley, and may others do more of it, you know, as we discussed. You know. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.